Hello, and welcome to this week's Arab Digest podcast. I'm William Law, editor of The Digest. Arab Digest is something of a rarity in Middle East analysis. Our daily newsletter has no sponsors, and we carry our podcasts without any advertising. It is our subscribers who support Arab Digest, and we intend to keep it that way. To find out how you can support a truly independent voice in the Middle East and North Africa, head to ArabDigest.org. When you go to the website, check out how you can receive our reader-supported daily newsletter for 2 months for free. That's right, 2 months for free. My guest today is Khalid Kheir. Khalid is a Sudanese political analyst, broadcaster, and activist, and the founding director of the think and do tank Confluence Advisory. Gaza is soaking up pretty much all the media attention, but today we're going to talk about another ongoing war, the war in Sudan. Khalid, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
When we last talked to you, Khalid, you described the humanitarian catastrophe then unfolding as the worst in the world, tens of thousands killed, 9 million displaced, 25 million in need of urgent humanitarian aid. That was back in January, early in January. What is the situation today?
I think it's fair to say it's gotten much worse in a very short space of time. So the famine that we've been warning about for months, if not years now, has definitely come upon us. There has been a reticence from international organizations, particularly the UN, to announce a famine. We're hearing heartbreaking stories of people in IDP camps in Darfur, in the streets of Khartoum, the capital, in different parts of the country, facing acute hunger and malnutrition, children in particular. The numbers that you have described earlier, numbers displaced and killed and in need of humanitarian, urgent humanitarian attention, have only increased. Health services are still very much non-functioning, over 80%, and we have the numbers of people dead that we haven't got solid numbers for. Estimates reach around 100,000, if not more. So we're hearing, very much that this war is becoming far more entrenched, and the sort of consequences of it are becoming graver and graver. For example, we're seeing genocide, and we have been seeing genocide and genocide-like acts committed by the RSF in Darfur. Just in the few days, we have seen pictures of members of the Sudanese armed forces disemboweling an enemy as they see him. Very gruesome images that are making their way around Sudanese social media of just the depravity that is coming across from the different belligerent sides as they continue to prosecute this war, seemingly to no end.
Yeah, and you're saying the UN still hesitant to use the word famine. Why?
Saying the word famine carries responsibilities. According to UN Security Council Resolution 2417, the world has a responsibility to act once a food insecurity of this type, once famine of this sort has been identified. And the UN, frankly, is uninterested in meeting that responsibility, as are many international actors, bilateral actors, etc. And so we're seeing a hesitance to do so. We were hearing in February that the UN was very close to announcing a famine, both in Sudan and in Gaza concurrently, and neither of those has happened. And the fact is that in the current climate that we're in, speaking about one conflict invariably leads to conversations about another conflict and the international response towards that. And the reason we haven't seen the pronouncement of famine, the declaration of famine in Sudan, is possibly also linked to the fact that the international community does not want to do that for Gaza. Similarly, we're seeing an unwillingness to call the genocide in Sudan a genocide, because that would also draw attention to the genocide in Gaza, and nobody wants to call that a genocide. And so we're seeing this sort of relational aspect of two rather distinct conflicts. And it's because the world has, I think, recognized, even international institutions have recognized, that the international structure, that the humanitarian legal structures that we once had, that we once relied on, are actually not robust enough to survive the sort of doublespeak we're seeing currently play out in conflicts across the world, with the exception, of course, of Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah. And you've mentioned Gaza and the war in Ukraine and Sudan's war, as you said, and as you said in our last podcast, is receiving very little coverage in international media. The reason given is that Gaza and Ukraine are sucking up all of the media interest. Do you think there's more to it than just that?
Yes, I think there's much more to it than just that. You know, what to cover is also a political choice, and those political choices are being made in newsrooms across the world every day. With Ukraine, you know, the West is, quote, on the right side of history, right? You have a incursion of sovereign territory by one state, Russia in this case, against Ukraine. And so there was a lot of attention on the war in Ukraine, one, because of the proximity. Ukraine is in Europe's backyard, but also the West believes that it's in the right side of history and is able to prove that. With Gaza, it's not a case of the West being on the right side of history. In fact, very much it isn't. But just the sheer scale of the deaths of Gazans and others in the West Bank has just been so large. And it's very clear that there is an impact, an immediate and perhaps irreversible impact on the Arab world because of the response of the West to the war on Gaza. I think with Sudan, if you're sitting in Washington, D.C. or Brussels or Whitehall, feels very far away. It doesn't feel like there's an immediate impact of what happens in Sudan to the West. And so we don't see it, you know, in news channels in different parts of the Western world. We had seen a lot of coverage in Arabic news media, and we still see some of it, although that, of course, also has been dominated by Gaza. I think the world can focus on two conflicts at the same time. It just chooses not to. And it's a very easy cop-out. This is a war between two main belligerent sides, now increasingly involving other groups. But it is a war between, you know, for power and for money. It's a tale as old as time. And at the same time, it's a war that is being waged on civilians. And I think we can all understand that one. That's a pretty universal story as well.
Yeah, indeed it is. And of course, the prism through which this war is explained oftentimes is that it's very binary. It's between these two generals, Hameti and his rapid support forces, and El Burhan and the Sudanese armed forces. But that ignores, and you've touched on this a little bit, the outside influences. So let's look at those influences, Khalid, beginning with Hameti's backers. Who are they, and who among them are the most influential?
Yeah, I think the issue, just to go back briefly to the two generals narrative, I think that was something that, you know, journalists sort of hung on to very easily at the start of the war because they had very little sort of foundational knowledge on Sudan. And my issue with that framing isn't necessarily that it's wrong, it's just incomplete. Yes, this, at the center of this are two generals who were brothers in arms for a very long time and who have since turned against each other in a very sort of Cain and Abel-like story. They were armed actors, both part of the security state, that fought hand in fisted glove against the people of Darfur in the genocide 20 years ago. But since then, they have, and in answer to your question, created and cultivated international relations and engagements that have allowed them to be in a position to wage this war. So for the RSF, for example, their strongest benefactor has been the United Arab Emirates, which for several reasons, the RSF have framed themselves as anti-regime and therefore anti-Islamist, and that chimes in well with the UAE's foreign policy in the region. They're the most importantly, I think, the relationship is underwritten by gold, and the extent to which the United Arab Emirates, as the world's largest gold market, is able to tap into smuggled gold from the regions that the RSF controls. But it also goes beyond Sudan. For the UAE, the RSF opens up an opportunity to the rest of Africa. If we think about the RSF as a transnational criminal franchise, much more than it is a military force, then the UAE in the RSF has a guard that can open and pave the way to other African countries, particularly in the Sahel and particularly in West Africa, which it has done. If you look at the way that the United Arab Emirates is engaging in investments across the continent, it is very much working in the regions where the RSF also has influence, where non-state actors like the RSF also have influence, where there are a lot of challenges to the state. and where they are, where the UAE has oftentimes not picked the side of the state, but has is very much, much more comfortable working with these non-state actors.
So that the RSF gives the UAE an entry point and a force, an armed force that could expand, that they could use to expand their profile and presence in the Sahel and throughout Africa, I suppose. What about El Burhan? Now, who's backing him, the general who runs the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces?
Well, with SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, which is headed by Al Burhan, it is much less about the personality at the top and much more about the institution. So SAF is the only really remaining institution in the country, and that is, of course, by design. And the SAF has attracted the kind of supporters that are very much in favor of supporting state institutions. So, for example, you have in the region the Egyptians, who have been steadfast supporters of SAF, the institution. Similarly, the Saudis have claimed a preference for the Sudanese Armed Forces, mostly because they also favor to work with the institution. Similarly, you have, for example, other entities in the region, the Algerians, the Qataris, the Turks, who, yes, may have some sympathy towards sort of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic ideological connections that the Sudanese Armed Forces has, but mostly it's the favoring of the central institution, and that can be seen as a much more profitable, much more robust guarantor of their foreign policy. Currently, the biggest prize in Sudan today is the Red Sea coastline. And so the Sudanese Armed Forces, which is currently controls the Red Sea coastline as well as other parts of the country, is able to get a lot of support, particularly from Iran and to some degree the Saudis, who are only across the water from Sudan's coastline, as well as more recently a variety of different actors and historically the Russians, for example, because of their ability to control that Red Sea coastline and because the war of attrition that has been waged since the beginning seems to be becoming more and more entrenched. And I think different actors, both within the region and further afield, are seeing that there is this increasingly Libya-style scenario that is becoming entrenched, where the Sudanese Armed Forces will be in charge of the Red Sea coastline, while the RSF will be much more in control of the western part of the country, closer to the Sahel. This means that depending on what your foreign policy interest in the Northeast Africa region is, whether it's linked to the Red Sea or whether it's linked to the Sahel, you will choose your preferred Sudanese security guarantor. What's interesting, I think, is that a lot of countries, or three countries in particular, have been able to cultivate relationships with both SAF and the RSF and have historically done so in order to be able to have access to both of those things. So, for example, the Russians have mastered this, I believe. The Kremlin has remained very close to Burhan and Sudanese Armed Forces, while the Wagner Group has been very close to the RSF and has secured their interest in the Sahelian region there.
And the other two countries?
So Israel, I think, is a notable one. We have seen how the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has been very close to Burhan. And Burhan, of course, had met with Netanyahu initially to start the normalization process a few years ago. And at the same time, we see Mossad has historically been closer to the RSF. And there were some conversations there around the degree to which there would be security engagement and exchange between the two. And until very recently, the United Arab Emirates was very good at doing this. Within the UAE, it is not a monolith. You have several, you know, members of the greater royal family, as well as, of course, the different monarchies of the different kingdoms within the different emirates, excuse me, within the UAE. And they had also been closer to either Burhan or Hemeti, which allowed the UAE as a country to be able to engage with both of them. Now, because gold is Sudan's biggest export and the UAE is the world's biggest gold market, effectively, both SAF and the RSF had been doing business with the UAE on gold, What we're seeing now, which I think is interesting, is the UAE's inability to maintain ties to both SAF and the RSF, its dogged support of the RSF, and the way that it has helped the RSF to humiliate the Sudanese armed forces on the battlefield has meant that Burhan and the SAF have pulled away from relying so much on the UAE, even economically speaking. So just in the past week, we have seen that the Sudanese armed forces have opened up a channel with the Qataris, of course, not on very good terms, diplomatically speaking and politically speaking, with the UAE. And they've opened up that pathway to the Qataris to help them process their gold, very much the service that the UAE was doing. So we're also starting to see that this policy coming from these countries isn't always successful.
You're listening to the Arab Digest podcast with me, William Law, and the Sudanese political analyst, broadcaster, and activist, Khalid Her. Arab Digest is a truly independent voice on the Middle East, North Africa. No advertising and no sponsors. In the information overload world in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. One insightful article a day and a weekly podcast from top experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Here at Arab Digest, we have put together a team of contributors you'll not find anywhere else. Check us out on arabdigest.org. When you go to the website, be sure and look out for the offer of a free 2-month trial to our reader-supported daily newsletter. Khalid, there is this savage war aided and abetted by outside players, but there's also an information war going on. Can you unpick that for our listeners?
Yes, I think, you know, from the outset, I've been saying that this war is being fought on three fronts. The first front being the battlefield, the second being the information in the information space, the info war, or the propaganda war, and then thirdly, in the mediation space. And in the propaganda space, we are seeing, you know, vast amounts of resources on both sides being put towards online trolls, being put towards PR. But by far, the RSF is outspending the Sudanese armed forces on PR. Of course, it has had this very long relationship with the Canadian-Israeli PR firm. There are also links between the RSF and a British firm and also a French firm, as well as reports of large troll farms in the UAE working on behalf of the RSF. The RSF leader, Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, who does not speak English, writes these very long, expansive tweets from his account in English. And so, of course, there is outside support given there. But I think the thing to note is that none of this is very successful in convincing people that the RSF is necessarily not doing the things it's accused of: genocide, atrocities, rapes and looting, etc. The point, I think, of these PR statements and these PR drives is to set a record that may later be relied upon to sort of sanitize the image of the RSF, some kind of way for the RSF to both plead ignorance of what it's accused of, but also just to have a record effectively to say, on this day, this was our comment on it, and we denied either knowing about this or doing it. I think they are planning ahead, so to speak, so that in the future they're able to say that we really were innocent of all the things that we have been accused of. Now, of course, what they're relying on there, that people have very short memories. But I think what this shows is a very fundamental misunderstanding by the RSF of how deeply they are mistrusted, hated within the country. What this really shows us in many ways is that the RSF media is not designed for Sudanese. Oftentimes it's in English. Oftentimes it's a way to curry favor with the international community, plausible deniability in the face of the international community. And we see the opposite for SAF. For SAF, a lot of their media, a lot of their outreach is in Arabic. It is very much intended to create a coalition of Sudanese against the RSF, a coalition that would be very forgiving towards the atrocities of the Sudanese armed forces, that would pave the way effectively for the armed forces to take over politically if and when they were in a position to do so. So, you know, we have PR plays a very interesting role in this war, depending on who you're talking to, what language it's in, and how much of your other policies you're putting to use to try and get a critical mass really against the other side.
Yeah. Now, when you were last on, you spoke about the role that civilians in the midst of this war are playing, civilian resistance committees, emergency response rooms. Talk about those civilians, the ordinary Sudanese who are showing extraordinary courage and resilience in the face of this horrific conflict.
Absolutely. I think the resistance committees, and in particular the emergency response rooms, are by far the greatest hope we have in the country so far. You know, we have a very young population in Sudan, and a population that remembers the December Revolution of 2018, 2019. And it's a population that, despite everything they've been going through in this war, has demonstrated huge resilience. Part of that is that there has been a reliance not on political structures, formal political structures, not on the two belligerent sides, one or the other, but a reliance on community cohesion that is critical, not just for the delivery of aid, but it's also critical for the peaceful coexistence that needs to be at the forefront really right now to help heal some of these very acute trauma of an unprecedented nature. I mean, it's bone deep at this point, and people are finding it very difficult to overcome that. Many of the stories we're hearing about now of people dying within a community space or dying in proximity of armed actors are related to, for example, somebody being considered to be from an ethnic group loyal to the other belligerent group. And that's the kind of community level suspicion that breeds, you know, a sort of a Rwanda-style scenario that I hope we very much avoid. But increasingly, the characteristics are there that tell us that perhaps that is the way that we're going. And the biggest defense that we have against that is the sense of community that is being woven by these volunteer groups. It is not by politicians. It is not by the belligerent parties trying to exonerate themselves from their atrocities. It is absolutely by these volunteer groups. And for that reason, they are being targeted by both sides in very different ways. They're either being put in prison or being killed. And what I think what is very encouraging is that those of them who have left the country still continue to organize and still continue to support and try to send, you know, financial help or help of another nature outside from outside of the country. And then that sort of gives me the greatest hope.
Yeah. Just again, for our listeners, what is an emergency response room? What does that entail?
So let's go back a little bit. When the revolution started in 2018, 2019, there were a series of neighborhood resistance committees, which functioned at the community level, at the neighborhood level, going door to door, spreading the word about, you know, protests, about the need to end the military regime of Omar al-Bashir, which by that point had lasted 29 years. And they were able to get a lot of support from within the neighborhood, but they were also able to work within networks across the entire country. And when the war started, just to say that the neighborhood resistance committees were absolutely the backbone of the revolution. And after the coup in 2021, they were really the backbone of the resistance then as well. And when the war started last year, in April, they immediately, having already had those structures set up these neighborhood emergency response rooms, which basically had groups of volunteers that focused on a key area, whether that was nutrition or protection or evacuating people or setting up, for example, shelters within schools or setting up soup kitchens for the community. And really, they're the ones, they're the only ones right now delivering aid to any great degree. It's not your usual international NGOs, UN, who have largely left particularly urban areas like Khartoum. It is absolutely these emergency response rooms, and they pool together their resources, much of which comes from the diaspora, and they pool together their sort of know-how and their knowledge, and they weave together a response program that looks at the different needs that people have within the community. So they also have women's rooms, for example, and for children as well, those who have been subjected to sexual assault and the like. And they're really adapting to and evolving with the needs that their communities face.
What is needed, do you think, Khalid, to end this war in Sudan? What are the steps that need to be taken right now to move towards an end?
Well, I mean, I think it is complex in that it's multi-layered and the actors are so many. I wouldn't say we're exactly at proxy levels right now, but I would say that Sudan is increasingly, the war in Sudan is increasingly behaving as a proxy conflict. We're seeing, for example, talk of, uranium and gold in Darfur. It's really driving the proxy elements of this war. But at the heart of it, we have to also look at the domestic element of it. Can these different belligerent groups, and there are not two anymore, can they get to a place where they can reach some level of consensus that the war must end? And once they do, can the international actors that support them also get to that place? And potentially, can those international actors who may be more persuadable get to that place before them and help to convince them to put down their weapons? So the first step for me has to be building consensus. If there is no diplomatic effort being put to building the consensus that the war must end, we won't get into a position where the war has any chance of doing so. Of course, we won't get everybody, this whole, mosaic of different actors to agree, but I think in a critical mass on both sides should be enough to at least get the conversation started. But once you have this consensus, the next step would be to build an incentive structure and a disincentive structure and leverage to be able to make this consensus into something more tangible, into the beginnings of an agreement. What do you do with the main triggers of this war? Issues of impunity and transitional justice, issues of what happens with the money, who has access to and who has control over the state finances and other natural resources, and what happens with the troops, should they be integrated or not? These are the real questions that, unless they are dealt with, there will be no end to this war. And in order to be able to have our sufficient answers to those questions, there needs to be much more attention, I think, put to what will the different sides agree to, what will communities agree to, victims, families, etc. That's going to take a lot of work to figure out what all these moving parts want, where we are with the leverage that's being put into position, how long it's going to take for some of these processes to take place, what exactly constitutes transitional justice. Is it Burhan and Hemeti being sent to the ICC, or is it much more of a collection of different transitional justice instruments such as Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, etc.? Once that is all figured out, and that will take some time, then you can formalize them into a mediation platform and really work out the kinks and make sure that everybody is represented, the different constituency groups, and ensure that the international community, those that support the war, but also those that support the peace, are able to get on board and that there's that critical mass. Now, for those three things to happen, you need to have a strategy on Sudan, which no country does, or no institution, including the African Union, the IGAD, or the UN has.
IGAD, that's East Africa's Intergovernmental Authority on Development. But what else is needed? What about international diplomacy?
You need to have sufficient diplomatic weight being brought to bear, and we haven't really seen that. We've seen very little diplomacy, not just in Sudan, but in the entire Horn of Africa region. We have to ensure that there are enough resources being put to this, and we have several envoys on the file right now who don't have a team, who don't have staff, who don't have resources to be able to fly around, etc. So it takes a lot of investment. It takes a lot of intentionality to get those three steps in order, and we don't have that. What we've seen right now is multiple, and there are at least five different mediation platforms who've all gone straight to step three. They've all gone straight to the mediation phase without having worked out A, the consensus, and B, the leverage and incentive structures. And that is the reason that every single one of them has failed.
Well, it's a very long, tough road, and as you say, the political will has to be there, the diplomatic determination, pressure brought to bear on these outside players with the threat of a proxy war looming, and I think most importantly, and you've made this point again in this podcast, is that the people of Sudan must be involved in whatever process happens to end this terrible conflict. And I thank you, Khalid, for your time, and we can only hope that the process begins for the sake of the people of Sudan, who've done so much and achieved so much in terms of removing a dictator, creating the beginnings of democracy, and are now still resisting what is happening to their country.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you very much for covering Sudan, Bill, in this sort of vacuum of coverage of Sudan. This becomes even more important and significant. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Khalid. My guest today on the Arab Digest podcast was a Sudanese political analyst, broadcaster, and activist, Khalid Herr. You'll have noticed that we bring you the podcast with no advertising and no sponsors. We are a truly independent source for analysis and commentary on the Middle East and North Africa. If you'd like to support our independent voice, head to our website at arabdigest.org, where you can find out about our reader-supported daily newsletter and how to get a free 2-month trial. The newsletter features the very best of MENA analysts, commentators, and writers, contributors like Khalid. Check us out on arabdigest.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and search our library of more than 200 podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or Amazon. Our podcast guests provide unique insights, insights you simply will not find anywhere else. Thank you for listening. I'm William Law, editor of the Arab Digest. Essential reading, essential listening from independent sources.